Hi.
How are you doing?
Good. And you are?
I'm Christian Kleinerman. I'm the group program manager of the relational engine in SQL Server, which is roughly the top half of the database engine.
Top half of the database engine. Okay, so you're going to tell us why developers are going to be interested in SQL Server 2008. So why would developers care?
I'm going to give you a sneak peek at why they should be caring about SQL Server 2008.
Okay.
There's more than we can cover in a short clip snippet. So we're just going to cover some of the characteristics. At a high level, we have continued to invest in T-SQL, the programming language very popular for the database. We continue to invest in the CLR integration, which we started in SQL Server 2005.
Mm-hmm.
We have this big theme going on in SQL Server 2008 around beyond relational, which is how do we store data that goes beyond traditional rows and columns. So you will see semi-structured data constructs, unstructured data, or different types of data models like the spatial data model.
So what does spatial data model mean?
So spatial data model means how do you store in SQL Server location-aware data? So imagine that you have a set of salespeople in your company, and you want to figure out who is the closest salesperson to a specific customer.
Mm-hmm.
For that, you need to understand relationships between two different points on the surface of the Earth and which one is the one that is closest. I have a couple of examples we're going to be able to see around this. For developers, we can do some very, very cool mashups, including Virtual Earth, which hopefully we'll also get time to see a little bit of that.
Okay, cool. So, what other stuff you mentioned? Structured, semi-structured,
the traditional T-SQL. We continue to invest in CLR. We continue to invest in XML.
Mm-hmm.
For those developers that are looking into XQuery, we have completed our implementation, adding the let clause. For people that are interested in property bag scenarios, we're going to see something called sparse columns in combination with filtered indexes. I think that's the high level, and that is what's going on inside the database engine. Outside the database engine, as part of SQL Server 2008, we have lots of other things like ADA.NET enhancements, the Entity Framework, which implements the Entity Data Model. So I'm not going to cover a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be focused mostly on what have we done inside the database engine.
Okay, cool. So, and you have demos for us.
You said that you wanted lots of demos, so I think that's what we're going to spend most of the time on.
Awesome.
So I think the first thing we want to show is related to areas of SQL Server that people have been asking us for a long time.
Okay. Now, we're in SQL Management Studio, right?
This is SQL Server Management Studio.
This is the 2008 version?
2008 version. I'm using a build of what's called CTP6, which should be out in mid-February, end of February.
Okay.
And one of the things that we always hear about is that if I start typing a query, will I get IntelliSense?
Ooh.
So that is the first thing you can see, where you can see AdventureWorks, and I can see human resources.
Ooh.
Department. And I can say give an alias, and the same thing if I do where D, I can say department ID greater than 2, and I can run the query.
Awesome.
So this is the very simple things that everyone has been asking for.
Sure.
Then when we did the CLR integration in SQL Server 2005, a lot of people said, you're focusing too much on the managed code. What's happening with T-SQL? Are you going to continue to enhance and invest in T-SQL?
Sure.
So just as a way to show that the message is true, that we continue to invest in T-SQL, here are a couple of what I call delighters or developer delighters.
Okay.
They are simple things like the ability to be able to initialize a variable in the same line.
Okay.
Most other programming languages have those things, but
sure,
I've been hearing for years, so it is there. And I can also do compound assignment operators by saying plus equals 1. And then if I do the simple select at B, I can run this batch and see that it works. So a couple of very, very simple delighters, variable initialization and the compound assignment. But this is just a way to say all these things that people expect out of regular programming languages, we are continuing to invest in T-SQL.
Okay, so I got some questions since we're talking about the IntelliSense and this stuff is hot. So I get IntelliSense on tables. Do I get them on views?
Yes, at this point, it is mostly around IntelliSense per statement.
Okay.
So the current build, or the upcoming CTP, will only do IntelliSense on select statements.
Okay.
And they will apply to both tables and views.
Okay.
And we are working on providing it for the other statements instead of the delete.
Okay.
And I don't think it's going to fit in this release. Time will tell. We're pretty much wrapping up the release at this point, whether we can be able to do it for the DDL statements.
Okay.
Or the create and alter statements.
Mm.
But I think select is the one that which is everyone's favorite.
Sure,
and
sure.
You just have it working on current builds.
Now, how about temp tables? I create a temp table. Will I get IntelliSense on that? Or
the honest answer, I don't know.
Okay. And I saw you did at, and
yes.
You got what looked like a completion list of variables. Now, is that scoped? Like, if I had a variable in one area and another variable, like, IntelliSense is smart and knows that it's in within a specific scope?
So, the answer for that one is, yes, it's scoped, but the real reason is because SQL Server doesn't enforce scoping of variables. It's one of those things we're going to fix one of these days in the language.
Okay.
Yeah, probably not our proudest moment. There's a lot of reasons why it's like that.
Uh-huh.
A lot of legacy also and applications that we do not want to break.
Sure.
But yeah, if you declare a T-SQL variable in the middle of a begin-end block, that's visible throughout the module. So just because of that, T-SQL works as you would expect. IntelliSense works as you would expect it to work.
You guys just did this to make IntelliSense easy. That's really...
Correct.
Now, how about stored procedures? I'm calling a stored procedure. Do I get parameter IntelliSense? Where if I call, you know, like add customer, I'll see first name, last name?
Not right now. It's on the list of different incremental steps we're going to be able to do on IntelliSense. I don't know how far we'll get in this release,
okay.
But we're clearly working on this, and we will slowly enable more and more parts of the programming language to be supporting IntelliSense.
Okay, cool. Great stuff.
So before we get into the fancier data models, like spatial or semi-structured data,
yeah,
I want to cover another one, which is among the top requested capabilities. And this is something that it is not sexy to demo, but it's very sexy to know that it's available in SQL Server. And it is around the new data types. In particular, four new data types we added to do better management and handling of date and time data types.
Mm-hmm.
So in SQL Server 2005 and previous releases, we used to have date time and small date time.
Right.
And if, for example, you needed a date only data type, you would be left up with all the work to trim the time portion and do comparisons and do such work.
Right.
So I have this table inside this NGDA database. Employees. And you can see that I've declared some columns with the new data types. With the old data types. I have date, and I also have hierarchy idea. I'm going to talk about this in a second. So if I use this database and I try to declare a variable of type date and do a conversion of this birth date column to a date type and compare it, if I run this, the results are not so interesting, but if I look at the execution plan, I get a cluster index scan, which, without going into query processing
in depth, you want to avoid.
You want to avoid scans.
Sure.
If this were a million or a billion row table, we would be sitting here for a long time waiting for this scan to complete. So the interesting thing is that if I go and create an index on that column, birth date, and I rerun the same query, if I were to do this in previous releases where this birth date was declared as a date time data type, then because of this expression, we would lose a track of the fact that this was a date, and we would be unable to use the index. But now if I run this and I look at the index, now you get an index seek and a key lookup, which tells you that the optimizer will go straight to the parts of the table that contain this specific value and gives you faster query performance, faster response time.
Awesome.
So we added four data types. The date, which is date-only portion. We added a time, which is the time-only portion. We had a date-time offset data type, which contains both date, time, and a time zone offset. And this one we did in sync with the BCL type as part of the .NET framework that just shipped with Visual Studio 2008.
Okay.
And there's matching semantics, so the same precision, same semantics. So this was a joint effort between the two divisions.
So that means, just for developers, if I'm, say, writing VB or C Sharp, I have my data types, they're going to be exactly represented. I don't need to do some weird sort of casting and know the different semantics.
Exactly. So you don't need to jump through a lot of hoops to get the value back to the client and maybe have a different precision. And if you do operations on the client from the server, they're different. No. They were designed together, and if you have a date time offset inside the database and you flow it all throughout the ADO.NET stack, it will be represented as a date time offset in the base class library in .NET framework.
Awesome.
And the last type that we added around date and time, well, it's called date time 2. We've got a lot of comments about the creativity of the name. but in reality, that's what the message we're trying to do. It's a date time with a few additional semantics, in particular, increased precision and increased range.
Mm-hmm.
And here in SQL Server, we are hardcore about application compatibility and not breaking apps. And that's what the old datetime is still there, it's still available, and it's still called datetime.
Now, if somebody wants to convert their data structures over, I mean, other than just, you know, that's kind of by themselves and updating or changing a column and seeing
very
that,
easy. Yeah. Do an alter table from the existing datetime column to the datetime 2, and we take care of the heavy lifting.
And everything else will just work.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Then we added another data type, which this starts to get a little bit into this beyond relational topic. And it's the one that is shown here, which is the hierarchy ID. And hierarchy ID is a new data type. Oops, my column almost got renamed. And this hierarchy ID is about modeling hierarchies. So there are lots of applications that end up having this need. Think of this HR table with employees where you want to track who is the manager.
Mm-hmm.
Or think of a folders and files paradigm, or think of a bill of materials. So all of these have hierarchical data in nature. So what would I have done in previous releases of SQL Server? Probably I would have just modeled a column here saying manager ID, and the manager ID would be reflecting back to the employee ID column.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting part of this comes down when you're writing queries, which is, how do I, for example, figure out everyone that works under Bill Gates?
Right, right.
That query, you can do lots of things. You can write in your application a recursive function or procedure that does the iteration, or you can do inside SQL Server a stored procedure that does the recursion.
Mm-hmm.
In SQL Server 2005, we added recursive queries via common table expressions. And in this release, what we're trying to do is make it significantly easier. Okay. And that comes as methods implemented on this hierarchy ID data type. So, you see that I have the employee node, which is this column I have, and the toString method. And toString may be very familiar for people working on the .NET framework.
Yeah.
The reason is very simple. We're leveraging the infrastructure we did in the CLR integration in 2005 to implement this data type. So this is internally a user-defined type implemented as a CLR class that has methods. And if I run this method, you will see that I get the employee node, and I get this column, which is an expression, and it has this encoding of the hierarchy. So root, you could say, is the CEO of my fictitious company here.
Right, right.
And /1 means they're in the first level. /1/1 means that it reports to the first level. And here you see how different people work or depend to different parts of the organizational chain.
Okay.
So the more interesting part is, how do you run the typical query? Give me everyone that is reporting to, in this case, I have someone called David Bradley. So now I can use very simple queries.
Mm-hmm.
I figure out what is the node of David Bradley, which is a subquery. And then I just say, dot is descendant, which is a method of the hierarchy data type, equals 1 from the external table. So I run this, and now I can very, very quickly and efficiently be able to enumerate everyone under David Bradley, without having to have iteration or recursive queries in my application.
Oh, that's awesome.
This translates to simplicity in application and high performance.
Right, right. And now, if I get those results before on the tree nodes on the client, if I wanted to do this on the client, I could as well, right?
So we have the type on the client, and yes, the methods will be available. You can select this column out, get the hierarchy ID type in the client, and then the actual UDT, which is a CLR class, will be available to invoke methods.
Awesome. Very cool.
Then another area that we always hear about is what's happening with the query language. So SQL Server is supposed to be this fantastic engine around querying data. And again, just to show a sample of some of the things that we've done, I'll show an extension to the SQL query language, which is conformant to the SQL 2006 standard, the ANSI standard. And this is very simple. I have this table called sales, and it has a state, a city, sales date, and a sales amount. And a typical query would be, I want to group by the date, the state, and the city, and I want to get the sum of the sales. So this is very simple totaling.
Mm-hmm.
Sale date, state, city, and a total.
Mm-hmm.
What if I want to compute subtotals between the different combinations? I want to see, for all the sale dates, what's the total regardless of state and city.
Okay.
So in previous releases, we had this thing called cube or rollup. And this generates all the possible subtotals for the query, introducing null values. So this introduced values show this number is the total for all state equals Florida, city equals Miami, regardless of the date.
Right.
And this one tells me this is the total for all city equals Miami, regardless of the state and regardless of the sale date.
Sure.
And someone may be thinking, well, if it's Miami, regardless of the state, doesn't make much sense.
Right.
Because Miami will always be Florida.
Sure.
So this is where the SQL standard went and created a concept of grouping sets. And I can say, generate a group by grouping sets. And I want to say, sale date is a dimension for subtotaling, and state and city should be treated together as a different dimension for grouping. So now if I run this, I see only the subtotals per sale date or per the combination of state and city.
Okay, so what's going on here is now city and state are sort of like the unique key, if you will, for the possible values here, meaning as long as it's a unique combination of city and state.
Correct. That's a way to think about it, or another way is to think of what are the dimensions that you want to use for totaling and aggregation.
Sure, sure.
So for people that, for example, are building applications that do a lot of analysis, a lot of reporting,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you will appreciate a lot the capability of doing these custom subtotals.
Now, you talk about grouping sets. Are there any restrictions for what you can group or can't group?
No. At this point,
you can group anything, even expressions or calculated values?
So it doesn't change the rules where you can use aggregation today. So
okay.
Today, for use aggregation, you need the types to be comparable.
Sure.
So we do not allow for the old legacy blob types or the timestamp data types, but probably you wouldn't want to be doing like aggregation on timestamps. So we didn't change that. All the other data types, integers, dates, strings, that you can use for comparison, and you can do aggregation today, you can use all of them.
Okay, and what about doing dynamic SQL with this?
You can absolutely generate dynamic SQL. We don't like dynamic SQL.
I know.
And we keep trying to introduce features that will lead to
fewer
cases of dynamic SQL, which they all come with a danger of generating SQL injection.
Sure.
So, yes, if you have to use dynamic SQL, grouping sets will work in dynamic SQL, but ideally you don't have to.
Sure. Awesome. Great.
Then let's go to another area, which goes into a new DML statement. And this starts to get slightly more elaborate. This is also an extension created based on the ANSI standard. And this basically is something that a lot of people have referred to as the absurd statement, which is sometimes do an update and sometimes do an insert.
That's absurd.
Absurd.
Okay.
The ANSI standard calls it the merge statement.
Merge statement. Okay.
So now when we talk about DML, we, for those of us that have been doing this for a while, we always say insert, update, delete.
Yeah.
Now we need to always add insert, update, delete, and merge. Because these
merge.
Are the ways
okay.
to modify the database. So I'm going to create this very, very simple table, cities, which has an ID and a name.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to create, insert three values, Orlando, Miami, and Seattle.
Okay.
And I'm going to create a destination table, ID and name. So cities, for example, could be a source operational table, and the destination could be a data mart or a data warehouse, and I want to load the data.
Okay.
So if I query these two, I see that there are three rows in the cities table and no rows in the destination. So this is how the new merge statement works. I say merge. I specify the destination, which in this case is dest, and I can give it an alias D. I say using, which is the source. I'm going to say cities, and I'm going to give it an alias, C. And I can specify the join condition, which is how will SQL Server compare rows from the source table to the destination table to figure out if they already exist or they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So I say using on C dot IntelliSense getting in the way, C dot ID equals D dot ID. And here I have the different conditions. I can say when matched, then it means that the row in the destination was found.
Mm-hmm.
The row in the source was found in the destination. So I can say when matched, simply do an update and set D dot name to C dot name. Okay. I can also give an instruction of what happens if it's not matched. When not matched, then I want to do an insert. And I will just specify which values to insert. In this case, I will say the ID of the source, C.ID, and the name of the source. Right?
Awesome. And we can add, obviously, more expressions here. So if I need to do particular logic where I just wanted to update, say, you know, sales or a manager, if a manager's change or something that was assigned to a city, the salesperson.
Yes.
You can go as crazy as you want, if you will.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not showing it here, but yeah, you can say when matched and you can include an expression. And you can go as crazy as you want, as you say, same as on the joining condition. So if I run this, I see three rows affected, and if I select from these two, I see that now the destination table has all the values. So the merge statement just went through this part, the insert clause, and inserted these three rows. So what happens if I modify a data? I say that the ID 2 is now Dublin. I can run the exact same statement I just typed. And if I go look at the results, now you see that both tables continue to be in sync.
Awesome.
Because some rows existed, some rows didn't, and the ones that existed just took the update.
Awesome.
And then there's a final extension here, which is that if I add a fourth row to the source, right? So the source has four, the destination has four tables, and the source has three. We have yet an additional clause I could have and say, when the source not matched, then, and I can easily say, simply delete it. So if there's anything in the destination that it doesn't fit in the source table, delete it, which is a way to say, make these two tables identical.
Okay.
And if I run this, I see four rows are affected, and if I look at the results, now they're both back to having three rows each with exactly the same values.
And I could do the same if I wanted to. Is there a when destination doesn't match, or would that effectively just be the if it doesn't exist statement?
This is if, it's not that if it doesn't exist, if the condition on the on doesn't match.
Mm-hmm.
So I could change the condition here to decide how to compare the rows from the source and the destination, and pretty much what this says is that the rows are in the destination, but are not matched according to that condition in the source. So this is a very, very powerful statement. It can get significantly longer, significantly more elaborate. But the interesting thing is that this inside SQL Server is a single statement. If I look at the query plan, it's just one big statement. It's doing a lot of operations, but it is a single operation. So we're touching the data only once and being as efficient as performance as possible.
And before we would do the if exists,
yes,
then begin, update, or insert.
It's very interesting to figure out how many stored procedures today start with a if exists, then update, else insert.
Right.
So all that logic now gets folded into a single statement inside the SQL engine.
And you're saying it's also optimized for performance.
Yes, yes. A lot of the work done here was around moving large amounts of data, populating, for example, data marts or data warehouses. So, yeah, we have a lot of performance work done here.
And some of the tools for data importing and data warehousing, this will use the same sort of merge operations?
Yes, yes.
In not DTS, but
integration services.
Yes, thank
so
you.
So, for example, you can use merge inside integration services.
Okay.
There's discussion on specific transforms, like the slowly changing dimension to out-of-the-box use merge, but at the very least, depending on whether we get to that or not, you can use merge inside the SSIS packages and leverage this capability to do more efficient data loading.
Awesome. Awesome. Great.
Okay. So around the beyond relational theme, one of the capabilities we have is on storing unstructured data.
Okay.
And unstructured data is pretty much file data.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you're building an application today, there's lots of people that come and ask the question, I have some tables, and they need to link to a file.
Mm-hmm.
Should that file be stored in the file system, or should it be stored in the database?
Yes.
And the answer is always it depends on where do you want to have more time, in the administration and the management, or in the performance and the programming model. So we have this new capability called FileStream, which pretty much says you use the programming model that you want, T-SQL or Win32, but you get SQL Server to manage all the data. So basically this means that you can have files in the file system, but managed by SQL Server. So the files in the file system, if you back up the database, we back up everything. If you restore it, we restore everything.
Okay.
But if you want to use Win32 to open the file, you can use Win32 to open the file. So it is like the best of both worlds.
So now, this is very interesting because it's such a common scenario. And I'll just do this to get out of the light here. Let's walk through some of the scenario. Okay, so we have our photo gallery, and previously our photo gallery was just a URL or a UNC
right.
to the web server, right? So you're saying now I am creating a user type, or there's now a new data type for FileStream.
It's not a new data type; it's an attribute
on
an existing type, var binary max.
Okay, so var.
So yes, I can create a table with this thing.
Okay.
And I can insert data into that row via T-SQL. I can set values to that file stream with T-SQL. I can select it out through select.
Mm-hmm.
But I can also go and open it with the file system. I can go and specify, there's some syntax in ADO.NET to say, give me the file name,
mm-hmm.
and I can give that file name to the file open, and I can get file stream in managed code. And file stream, it just coincidentally, the class that manages files in that the framework is called FileStream,
sure.
which is also the name we have here. So I can get a managed FileStream class to just open and close the values from this specific stream.
So when I'm pulling the value, am I pulling the location of the file stream, like the unique identifier, or am I pulling the file stream object itself? Like how does the, when I say select star to get, you know, Dan's photos, what's actually returning? Is it, if it's var binary max, is it a big blob?
Yes.
Or is it, okay.
So if you say select star, big blob is coming down.
Okay.
If you want just a name that you can use to open the path, we have some intrinsic function which says select, I think it's called path name. So you can say select path name of this value and get it out.
Okay.
So
awesome.
I'm not going to go into all the details on creating an app,
but
I want to show how to enable a database to store file stream content.
Sure.
Right. So the first thing we do is I'm going to alter the same database to create a file group, and it says contains file stream data. And
so you do this on a database basis?
It's on a database basis, which is pretty much, think of the folder that will be used to store the all these files.
Okay. Now, this also will inherit from the file system whatever database permission. So, like, if you're not a DB owner or somebody that doesn't have permissions to view the picture, does the file system automatically inherit those permissions, or how does permissions work?
We start relaying all the permissions to SQL Server.
Okay.
So we pretty much go and re-ACL the folder that you specify to be managed by the SQL Server security account.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, all access to these files are redirected to SQL Server.
So as part of
this feature, we're installing a kernel mode driver, a filter, that will go and verify. And if you're trying to access files in this folder, the actual permissions and the access will be redirected to SQL.
Now, if I'm setting this up, last question. I'm setting this up, say in a hoster. Do they just install SQL Server 2008 and they get that kernel mode driver, or is that something unique that they have to set up one time to do this?
It's part of the setup of SQL Server 2008.
Okay.
As part of setup, you'll be asked whether you want this or not.
Okay.
So you'll see FileStream show up as in the setup itself.
And that's in every version, or is there a specific version?
This is in all SKUs, all editions.
Including Express?
Including Express.
Awesome. Okay.
Cool. Lots of internal debate on that one, but yes. So I'm going to say alter the database and add a file to that specific file group I just created, and I give it a path. So I have this path open here, C demos and GDA. Mm-hmm. It's empty. And when I go and create this, you see that SQL Server just created a file, a folder, and has some internal structure that we'll use to manage the file stream data. So at this point, I can go and simply use this database. I will create a table called media clips, and it says media clip var binary max, and here you see the new attribute called file stream.
Right.
And I can run this, and I can insert a row into that table, which I am just giving it a description saying it's a message from the chairman. And I could very easily do a select star from dbo.media clips. I see the one row. I see the column called media clip, which has the default value I inserted.
Mm-hmm.
And I could also do something like data length of the media clip column, just to show that it's empty. I'm going to leave it here because we will be able to show in a minute how the data is being populated. So I'm going to show you just some of the things that will be showed in the launch, which will be going around the world, multiple countries in the next month or two. And I'm not going to show the spatial capabilities from here because I'm going to show the live mashup with Virtual Earth. But I have this application here that has an upload new video clip.
Mm-hmm.
And from this, I can very easily browse a file, select a video file, which happens to be 2 megabytes, and I just say open it, and the insertion will have happened to SQL Server. So for this, what I'll do is I'll show the code. You see, if I run the query, it's two megs here.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just show a little bit of the code used, this managed code used to insert the file stream data. So for this, I have this map viewer, and I have this media helper file. This is just to show how we will be programming to file stream by using the Win32 programming model. Get the name, open it, and do the insertion of the file just by directly using the Win32 write command instead of having to do the insert through the T-SQL. One of the benefits is that if I am to stream this video out, mm-hmm. I can use, again, the Win32 API.
So, right.
This thing is not opening. It should open soon. But the more interesting thing, here you see all the code. The font is not the greatest. Here you see some of the calls. We're wrapping this as part of ADL.NET in SP1 of Orcas. I don't know if you're okay with code names.
Orcas is fine.
Orcas is fine. And this is the actual
VS
code.
VS 2008. Then.
Yes, VS 2008.
People get confused.
Yeah. And here you see a little bit of the code where you can say SQL Native Client, open a SQL file stream, and you can give it a file path value. And this value is a query that is embedded down here, where I can say select media clip column dot path name, and that gives me a name that I can use. This application, I'm not going to spend a whole bunch of time, but I can do play video clip, and we can just stream the file
mm-hmm.
out of SQL Server and have an application like Media Player display the contents that are stored in SQL Server.
Awesome. Very cool.
So the other interesting thing, which I'm not going to show here, is that if I back up the database that contains this file stream data,
mm-hmm.
all the files will be backed up together. So this additional folder that was just created looks like just an additional file group or additional file. And if you back up or you restore the database, all the content will be in the same place, which is one of the biggest pains that people have today. When the files are stored in the file system and you just have some URL or some UNC path, keeping them in sync is hard.
Sure.
But now SQL Server is doing the heavy lifting to ensure that these are in sync.
So when I actually back up, it takes, I guess, that file system, that directory, and just puts it into the SQL backup file.
Yes.
Awesome. Very cool.
Okay. Then we're going to jump into a couple of other things. One is also a new capability in the engine.
Okay.
Around how to pass large volumes of data from the client application. And for that, we call them TVPs, or table value parameters. So the scenario is the following. I have, say, an order in my application and some order line items, mm-hmm. and I want to pass all this to a stored procedure. Mm-hmm. So the line items may be a variable number, maybe, I don't know, 5 for some customers or 50 for some others. Mm-hmm. So how do I declare that stored procedure? Some people go and do XML representations of the values. I've seen also applications with 2,000 parameters, of which half of them are commonly not used.
Right.
So the scenario is very simple. And I know that whoever's tried it will largely appreciate this new capability, which is materialized in the following way. We have these new table types. And it is, the way to think about it is an aliased version of a temporary table definition. So I can say create type, I give it a name, TVP_table, and it's defined as table of iInt. I could have any table definition, I'm using the simplest one for demo purposes. Mm-hmm. So I have this type, and also for illustration purposes, I'm going to create a very simple table, which has a single integer A column. And look at this procedure now that I can create. I can create a procedure called USPTVPInsert that has a parameter at P, and the type of the parameter is this table type I just generated. Inside the procedure, I can go and say insert T select star from at P. So I go and create this, and just to show that the stored procedure is working, I can go and say declare a variable of the table type, insert into the variable, execute the stored procedure passing this TVP. And what this should do is, it reads from at P, inserts into T. So if I read from T, I have one value. So this is, not sure how interesting it is.
Okay.
This is significantly more interesting if we show this being invoked from a client application, say from an ADL.NET application. So for that I have VS 2005. I have it here because I have imported some of the snippets I created to make it easier on the typing.
This shows that you can use Dynamo Framework 2.0 with SQL Server 2008. That's what
that's shows. A very good way to show it, to say. And I'll just go ahead and create a new console application. I'm going to use C#. And I have several snippets. One of them is the typical headers to use the ADL.NET stack. Mm-hmm. So I have TVP headers. Simple standard using statements, and I have also standard code for establishing a connection, data source, integrated security, connect to TempDB. Okay. And here's where it gets interesting. I'm going to create a parameter setup, which is, I have a command. What is the name of the command? I want to invoke the stored procedure, which I called USPTVPInsert. USPTVPInsert. I have a parameter name, which I call P, if I'm not mistaken. And here's one of the interesting additions as part of the latest .NET framework, is that the DB type, SQL DB type, is of type structured. And what structured tells the ADL.NET stack and the engine stack is that this is a complex parameter type.
Okay.
And I could use one of two things. I could use either an IEnumerable of T and set that value to a parameter, or I can do a much simpler approach, which is buffered. So do this only for a small number of records. If you want to insert a larger number, use an IEnumerable interface. But I can use the good old data table. So for that, I have a new data table. I give it a name. The column name, I think I said it was going to be called I. And look at this code. Declare a data table, give it a name, add a new column called I and of type integer, and I have a loop for int I equals 0, less than 100, plus plus, add. So I'm adding 100 rows to
You're
this.
You're creating a, on the client a table of 100 rows.
Correct. So if I just come here, set a breakpoint, execute this app, and now step through this last statement, I go back to my management studio. And I look at the query I have to read from the table. I refresh this, and you can see from the total that I have 101 rows, which says that 100 rows were inserted all through a single parameter of type table type.
Cool. Very cool.
Okay, last two things, because we may be running out of time.
Okay.
And one of those is around the spatial capabilities.
Yes,
I talk about location-aware data and beyond relations, so this is part of what we're doing like that. And SQL Server adds two new data types, one called geometry and another one called geography. Geometry is used for location data, which usually will be referenced to planar coordinates. So just to give you an example, this is a small app.
And that means latitude, longitude? Is that what you're talking here?
No, I'm talking at this point just pure coordinates where the meaning of the coordinates is given by the application. So I can, the best way
so
to show
it could
with
really
an
be for even virtual worlds or
this
anything
can,
in between.
This can be for anything. Yeah. And in reality, this is a geometry library. That's the way to think about it. So it doesn't even have to be location data.
Okay.
So look at this. I have this variable declared as a geometry type. And we have this standard standard method. This is part of the OpenGIS standard, which says this is a polygon where the coordinates are 10, 10, 10, 40, 40, 40, 40, 10. You can read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, just select this. And someone put together this nice application that I can run and have it be drawn. And someone was even more creative to say that the first column will be the first column returned by the query in here will be drawn using this fill color and using this border color. So I can run this, and you can see the results.
Mm.
And if I were to run SQL Server Profiler in the back, you can see that all these queries are hitting the engine directly. So I can have multiple drawings. I can have two geometries and just draw them with different colors. Nothing very interesting, but this is just to show that it is very basic geometry operations. But then you can start to ask SQL Server to compute the union of two operations. And you can see that I have shape 1 and shape 2, which are two variables.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say select at shape 1 ST union of shape 2. And this will cause SQL Server to generate the combination of the two shapes. And you can see back here that the operations are happening. Or I can ask for the intersection of these two. And you see that SQL Server returned the yellow one, the red one, and this orange one is a shape returned by SQL as an intersection. Then I can do slightly more complex drawings. And for that, I'm not going to type here all the coordinates of the points. I
sure,
have this
sure.
stored in a table. I have a countries table, and I can say, give me the coastline for the country name Australia. And if I go through this, you see the queries executing in the background.
Oh, beautiful.
And this is a geography of the coastline of Australia. Then you can perform some additional computations in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But you can say, you know what, that same coastline, generate a buffer, which is an area around it. I'm going to run it because it's going to take a little bit. Generate an area around, and I can specify the width of that space. And you can see that there are some tricky parts, like this bay down here and that, this area here.
Mm-hmm.
And SQL Server will do the computation. All this according to the OpenGIS, which is the standard for geographic data. And produces the results. So this is the pure geometry data type. The more interesting one is geography, which now it is what you were talking about, which is latitude and longitude.
Okay.
And once you have latitude and longitude, you can start doing some very interesting applications with virtual Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, what I've done is exactly that. I create a very simple mashup where I have a map of the US and I can type here a zip code. This happens to be the one I live in. I can say draw the region, and you see that the query that is going to go back to SQL Server is select the ID, give me the shape from a zip codes table I have where the ID is what the user entered. So it gives me this graph. I can go and say the one in Redmond, which is where the campus is, and you see that that is the actual shape or the geometry of the whole zip code. And if I go look back at these queries, they are being executed in the back. But that is not very interesting. This is using SQL Server as a bag of bytes.
So real quick, just to talk about what we've done here. Now, how did you get the locations of this zip code? Is SQL Server providing geo data? Is there a
No. So at
was
this point,
through OpenGIS or something to get the data, and then you just load it into a table?
Someone from our test team. This is how we got it. He went and got, I don't know if it's public domain, I'm fairly sure that it's public. He got a database with all the locations for all the zip codes. And that's what I'm using. I have in the background a database that for each zip code, it gives me the coordinates. So what this application is doing is goes to the database, brings the coordinates, which are stored with a geography data type, and asks Virtual Earth to do the rendering.
Can we look at that date table just
real
quick for the postal code lookup?
Yeah, so I can go to the census database, and I have actually lots of interesting data sets. I have census bureaus, congressional districts, the shapes of the states, shape of the zip codes, and you can see that I have the ID of the zip code, the state that it belongs to, and I have actually the shape stored in two ways. One is the geometry, which is the planar representation, and the other one is the geography, which is the representation as it would be reflected on the surface of the Earth.
Awesome. Very cool.
However, these queries are not using SQL Server for anything interesting. It's like, I have some bits there, give me those bits back, and Virtual Earth is doing the interesting things. But think of what happens if I click somewhere out here, and I ask SQL Server, give me all the zip codes that are intersecting that point that I clicked. So now Virtual Earth gives me the latitude and longitude, and SQL Server runs a very interesting query in the background. It took a while. If you look at the query, it's something like, convert, this is the latitude and longitude as passed to me by Virtual Earth, and give me all the items from the zip codes table where the geometry intersects the parameter I'm passing in. You're also going to see that it took whole 12 seconds. So another capability in SQL Server 2008 is to use a spatial index. And for that, if I click here, we will use a very simple grid technology to be able to narrow down which are the set of geometries that affect the point and perform the intersection operation way faster. So if you see that I'm clicking now here, you see that the UI is significantly faster.
Right,
and
right.
If I go back and look at the duration, whereas without the index it was taking 12 seconds, now we're talking all of them are sub-second operations.
So you talked about this index. What exactly is it doing? Is it doing, does it know sort of based on the coordinates, or what's going on there?
So basically you go and say create an index, and you specify what are the different grids that you want to use for indexing. So what it does is it takes the whole space, in this case the whole surface of the Earth, and breaks it into different layers of grids. In this case we have four layers.
Okay.
So for example, and the index has information on which points or which values in a specific table lie within each of the different regions. So for example, if we want to know if a point is within the whole surface of the Earth, the index can tell us it is within this grid. So very quickly we know that we do not need to search on all the other points that we have. And as soon as we determine that it's in that part of the grid, we can determine the next one. And the next one, we do that four times.
Okay.
Until we very, very quickly narrow down the set of possible values in this table that are intersected by that.
And then you do the...
Then we do the actual operation of figuring out if they're intersected. Once we narrow down the space fast, we do the actual comparison.
And intersection is just something built into SQL Server 2008.
Yes, yes.
Now, what other operations can I do on data in addition to intersect?
You could do lots of things. You can do unions of types, buffers of types. But the more interesting part is when you start to leverage the power of the query processor in addition to the geometry or the spatial operations.
Okay.
So for that, I have a variation of this app where I created this. Think of it as a management studio or a query analyzer that I have a query. And whatever I run here, I can get it plotted into this map. So I have this human resources.employee table, and basically it says that all the columns that are returned will be added to the pushpin information. So I have the name of some sales representatives, and I have all that information. The title, address line, city, etc., which I'm returning here. Title, address line, city.
Give me just 1 second to look at that query. Okay, so there's a query, and then...
So this is human resources employee view. I filter where the title is sales representatives, and I return a series of columns, state, province, city, address line, title, name. And what I do is I return the shape, which is getting plotted by Virtual Earth, and I pass to Virtual Earth the rest of the context, such that all the other columns are displayed.
Sure.
So I can start to leverage both the spatial capabilities with the query processing capabilities. So I have a function that's called sales total. And I can say this is for a specific employee ID, and call this column sales, and I can run this query again. And if you look at the push pin, I have an additional field called sales that gives me the total for that employee.
Awesome.
I can start to also say, you know what? SQL Server is for interesting analysis, so I want just the top three, and I want to order it in decreasing sales order. Order by sales in decreasing. So I want to see who are the top three salespeople in our region.
Sure.
I run this, and now I'm graphically seeing the results to be only three.
Awesome.
And you were asking about what other operations. So we saw another instance of buffer around the Australia coastline. What if I generate a buffer around this? So I say, instead of giving me the shape, give me the shape with a buffer around this. And that converted to a string. So what this will do is generate, since these are points, a buffer around it is pretty much a circle around it. I run this, and now I see three circles generated.
Now, are these are sized by sales?
So I could have done that.
Okay.
which is probably how people would use it. But I decided to use a fixed number. Actually, I could have passed here a sales amount, and we would have gotten what you want.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why it picked a fixed number is to show that, for some reason, I hope the camera catches it, it seems that the circles in Canada are larger than in the U.S.
Yes, yes.
That's the million-dollar question. And the reason is, it's either a bug in SQL Server, or it's an artifact of the visualization that we're using. And obviously, it's the latter, which is that... Because of the curvature of the Earth,
yeah,
the way these circles are displayed, it seemed to be larger over in Canada or as you approach the North Pole. So what I just did is I switched virtual Earth to use a 3D rendering of the Earth. And now you can see the exact same data. And if you look at this circle, as well as the other circles, including the one in Canada,
wow,
they are clearly all the same size.
This is awesome. Wow. I could definitely see a lot of people using... all sorts of interesting geo mashups.
Yeah, there are lots of interesting applications, and even if you're not in the spatial business, we believe lots of applications have location data. Where are the sales? Where are the districts, the points of sales? All that information can now be modeled and analyzed using SQL Server.
Awesome.
And I'm going to do a very last one, a one-minute one. I'm
okay.
Out of time, which is around sparse columns.
Now, what are sparse columns?
Sparse columns, in its simplest definition, sparse tables are tables that have a lot of empty space.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of nulls in it. And even though SQL Server stores nulls pretty efficiently, if you have tens of thousands of nulls in a table or in a row, it ends up adding up to a lot of space. So, the scenario I have is a property bag scenario. Think of, we have a set of employees, and each employee has a different set of properties. So for some people, I will be able to fill in the hair color. For some people, I'm going to be able to fill in the address where they live. Not everyone has all the information. Or think of a product catalog. Product catalog, some items have a size specifier, some items have a color specifier, but the overall table is sparsely populated.
Yeah, sometimes people did name value pairs instead of a row column because there'd be so many empty
right. So this
values.
Is exactly about that scenario. The name value pair. And instead of having to go and change the model of the application to use a vertical table, because
sure,
otherwise you would be lots of empty space,
sure,
how do we transfer the problem to SQL Server and leave application developers take the easy part, which is model these things as columns as you would naturally would. So just for illustration purposes, MTV, I'm going to create a table. And I can say let's keep it simple, A... This is the name. Oops, sorry, name. Varchar 10. Just for time reasons, I'm going to say that I'm going to declare this as sparse.
Okay.
I'm going to say some ID, and this is an integer, and I'm going to say this is also sparse. And because we're after this name value pair modeling question, we have created a concept of a column set. And I can have a new column called C, which is of type XML, and I will say that it's a column set for all sparse columns. right? So now I can go and insert into this table a the name and the ID, the values, and I will do just a simple name A, and this one doesn't have an ID, so I'll say null, and I'll insert a second row, which is, let's say that it doesn't have a name, and it does have an ID. So if I insert these two values, these two rows,
mm-hmm.
Now, when I created the column set, I redefined the meaning of select star from A. And what this does is that it gives me only the column set for all the sparse columns. And you see that now I get an XML representation of all the values that are not null.
Okay.
What this means is that if I have large number of properties, price, color, size, this way of using a column set will just give to my application the results of the values that are not null. And the more interesting thing is that now I can insert into A by using the C column, and I can set a specific value, say an XML that says I want to set just an ID of 7, and if I insert this, and now I do a select name, comma, ID, I see all three columns. Name, ID, and the XML representation, which is the star. And I can see that I just inserted a value that has a null A and a 7 value.
Awesome. So if I really needed to just do the comma, comma to get the values, in certain cases where I want to query, I can just choose the columns. Like if I
Correct.
Know size and color will always be on t-shirts, I can just say select size, color. And then if I really need all the property bags where I know things are going to be different, then I get that. And then on the client side, am I parsing XML or... with XML that comes
yes.
back?
So you said it, I couldn't have said it better in terms of if you want a specific column, you ask for it explicitly. Otherwise, you do star, and star gives you the non-XML. The null values as XML. And on the client side, right now you're parsing XML. The ADO.team is working on some interesting programming model on top of this. I don't think it's going to make it in this release that's coming out, but hopefully very soon you're going to have a nice programming model around this.
Very interesting, very interesting. Wow, that's awesome stuff.
And I think we're way over time.
Okay, Christian, thank you again, and I know developers are going to like this. So definitely check out SQL Server 2008.
Thank you.
Thanks.